From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On December 15th, the U.S. military formally ended its mission in Iraq. More than 44,000 U.S. service members died in the country. More than 32,000 were injured. It's hard to know how many Iraqis were killed. Documented civilian deaths come in at more than 100,000. Others say that figure is much larger. In the days after that last convoy of U.S. troops left Iraq, we're asking how the U.S. has left the country and the lessons learned by that experience. Our guest is the filmmaker Dodge Billingsley. He was there to document that last convoy. He was also there when the first troops arrived in the country, so he can compare how things have changed. He can also talk about the challenges that remain and what the U.S. has done to alter the physical and political landscape of the region. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Everyone knew that the U.S. Was getting ready to leave Iraq, that a formal end to the U.S. military mission there was coming to an end, but soldiers kept the particulars to themselves and away from insurgents. In the days after that last convoy of U.S. troops did leave the country, we're asking how the U.S. has left Iraq. We're also talking about the lessons learned by the experience. Our guest is the filmmaker Dodge Billingsley. He was there to document that last convoy, but he was also there when the first troops arrived in the country. He can help us sort of compare how things have changed and talk about the challenges that remain. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Dodge Billingsley is here in the studio, the director of Combat Films and Research. It's a political and military think tank and a documentary film company. It's based here in Salt Lake City. And Dodge Billingsley, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Scott Thornton here. He's a producer at Combat Films. He was there with Dodge Billingsley, and we're going to be talking to him a bit as well. And so, Scott Thornton, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Dodge Billingsley, let me start with your mission, I guess, if we can put it that way, when you went, I guess, to observe, to witness. What was the idea? What did you want to go to Iraq to see or to do, I guess?
Just like you say, observe and to witness. I mean, having convoyed in with the first troops in 2003, and I'd made some other trips into Iraq during the nine-year period, but it was kind of felt like an important time to be there as we're going to leave the country as well. And I didn't want to fly out. It was important to convoy, just for personal reasons, to convoy out since I convoyed in, because that's a grueling experience in itself, especially the older I get.
I guess one thing that struck you, you've said, is that, I can't even remember. You produced a documentary called Virgin Soldiers, which I want to play some clips because I think it's interesting to compare then to now. Mm-hmm. And one of those things is the convoy itself into getting to Baghdad, which took days and days.
Yeah, two and a half weeks.
2.5 weeks, coming out not that many days, which I guess in of itself reflects the change.
Correct. I mean, it took 2.5 weeks to get in. It took 36 hours to get out. And we actually traveled twice as far because we'd left Al-Anbar province, Al-Asad Air Base, which is like you got to go 5-6 hours toward the Baghdad area and then you drive straight south from Baghdad. So it was almost twice as far as the Marines and I went in 2003. But of course, we were fighting on the way up. We weren't necessarily fighting on the way back. And the mission was interesting because the commander said, if we make an engagement, if we get tied up in a fight, our mission is not to fight back. Our mission is to get out, which is completely different. I mean, normally you would stop and you would engage. Yes. Yeah. This one is if you get hit with an IED or an EFP or someone engages you, take note of it. But our mission is to get to Kuwait, to get out of Al-Anbar province, close down Al-Asad Air Base, and get out of Iraq.
So how did the atmosphere, the sense of what was going on, it must have been completely different. On one hand, there's all of this anxiety about what they're going to expect, what kind of danger they're going to confront. That wasn't at all like that leaving in some ways. I mean, there's always that sense of anxiety, I expect, when you're in, when you're in a combat zone like that, I suppose. Yeah. You can even call it that anymore, I guess.
That's true. In the beginning, you know, in 2003, nobody knew what to expect. Yeah. We still had a vague notion of weapons of mass destruction, Scud alerts. You know, we had Patriot missiles, anti-missile system batteries everywhere. On the way out, they did highlight four potential hazard spots on the route where traditionally troops have been being hit still by IEDs. And in fact, the convoy we were on did get struck by an IED.
Yeah.
Not our vehicle. In fact, it was a second.
But it wasn't far from you, though, was it?
No, it wasn't far. We were in the route clearance and in the first part of the convoy. They split the convoy up into five serials or five sections. The second section was hit by an IED, but it hit between the second and third vehicle, so it sort of blew the back off of one and did some damage on the headlights and stuff of the front of the third vehicle, but there were no injuries. But other than that, it was pretty uneventful. We had a lot of maintenance issues, a blown tire here. One of the MRAP bumpers fell off or something. I don't know. It's some issues with, especially with Serial 4. But otherwise, yeah, it was just kind of like not a race, but just let's get out. You know, just get out. It couldn't happen. It just went by too slow, you know, to get out. But.
It's interesting you said you wanted to go out that way for personal reasons. Do you feel a sort of personal connection to the soldiers or the experience in some
way? I definitely did with the Marines because I was with them for 5 months, yeah. More or less. I'm embedded basically in 29 Palms, California. So we got to know those guys quite well. And we still, I mean, it's a new world we live in. I'm still Facebook friends with almost the entire squad.
Wow.
You know, we still email each other. And likewise with the soldiers of 4-6 Infantry, which we just, you know, the unit we were just with, we spent about 2 weeks with them. It wasn't a long time, but they only had one mission, and that was to close the base and get out of Al-Anbar province and out of Iraq. So if you stay with them and you're there documenting what they do, so you become kind of in part of that bubble, and so you do make connections and stuff. So, but the convoy thing for me was a simple bit of closure. I mean, convoying in and convoy. I mean, it's just personal, but I mean that convoy ride, it's terrible. Riding in a tracked vehicle, it is just terrible, and for days on end with the Marines on the way up. So this one, I'm being only 36 hours. I'm 10 years older, but it was still terrible. It was still a rough ride. The MRAP's a much better vehicle, much smoother, much more comfortable. But it's
which is another reflection of how things have changed in 9 years, I guess.
Well, yeah, the MRAP itself wasn't even
– this is a military
– it's a mine-resistant armored vehicle, yeah. You know, V-shaped hull, yeah. Different variations. But we didn't even have that in the U.S. arsenal or in our fleet. In 2003. It was a response to the mine warfare that was going on against U.S. troops. They were taking so many lives and creating so many casualties. So now it's all MRAPs.
Yeah. What were the questions you were asking back in 2003? I mean, what is it you were trying to get from the soldiers in those days compared to now? I mean, were the questions at all similar? Were you trying to learn the same kinds of things from these guys?
That's a good question. I don't know if I actually went into 2003 with many questions as much as I just wanted. I mean, it was a question. I wanted to see what it was like with a frontline infantry unit. I'd been in Afghanistan the year before, but it wasn't a lot of conventional force type engagements, a lot of special forces operations, you know. And so Iraq was this massive conventional military push, you know, like almost like you go back to Korea or World War II where, you know, you had a target. We're going to go in. We're going to invade. We're going to take the capital, depose the regime, grab the key installations, and hopefully it would all be good.
Yeah.
So I was a bit intrigued by that notion. It's, you know, this whole idea of what this campaign was going to be like. You know, and it was interesting to be with the Marines. I mean, because I wanted to go with the frontline unit, combat infantry, Marines, average age probably 20. they were a very interesting mix of people. So
yeah, it's as you sort of convey in the film Virgin Soldiers, and I want to play a few clips, in fact, because I want you to talk about the difference, because it seems pretty stark in some ways. Because of course there was anxiety in 2003 of what to expect. That seemed natural, and I just wondered if it seemed commonplace now the way. You know, the way the soldiers were thinking about it. Let me play. This is a clip that comes from your film that you produced when you first went into Iraq, when you were embedded there. This is a Lance Corporal Velasquez. And it's interesting because how they were thinking about these young men in those early days, none of them had seen combat. This was not a commonplace event for young people. They didn't really...
Nobody knew how they were going to respond under pressure.
Exactly.
And it was, yeah, that was really fascinating to see. Everybody had a different way of going about getting mentally prepared for it. And I actually felt like the way the Marines did it was a little bit, I would have never done it this way. I remember the first sergeant gathered everybody together when he knew invasion was imminent and just said, okay, this could be the last week of your life. You got your house in order, got your last letters written. I'm like, what kind of pep talk is this? This is like the dumbest pep talk ever. I mean, it depressed me. I left the tent.
Is that right?
Yeah, I didn't. I'm like, to me, I just kind of started thinking about, yeah, I actually could die. Because I guess in a strange way, I don't really think about that when I'm out there. So I didn't really want to have to think about it. But I think he wanted to get his young Marines prepared. He didn't have that sense at all. Coming out.
Yeah.
Let me play that moment because this is Staff Sergeant Kelly. I'll get to Velasquez here in a moment. But I do think that's an interesting moment. He, as you say, he's sort of getting the troops ready for battle, and it's an odd, as you say, pep talk. This is from the film Virgin Soldiers.
You guys got to think about some of these scenarios. Remember we talked about some of the scenarios? You guys got to think now. Can I pull that trigger? You better give some serious thought. Because it's time about shooting somebody that's shooting at you. It's not then. You have to make the decision now. If you haven't made that thought or haven't made those thoughts yet, you need to sit down and think about that sometime. Give yourself some time alone and start thinking about that. But just remember, hey, this very well could be the last 9 days of your life. How do you want to spend that? I'll tell you what, some serious here. I don't think anybody should ever have to be in a situation, but we are. And if not us, who?
That sentiment of, if not, we don't want to be here, but look, we have to be here. This is our, I mean, you get that sense throughout the film in some ways. Look, we didn't have any choice. This is the thing that we have to do, so let's just get the job done. That was interesting. Do they still think that way, do you think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I definitely think so. What's interesting about the armed forces, the Marines, the Army, is when you get down to the soldier level in the squad, politics disappears. It's kind of a cliche, but you really do fight for the guy next to you, and they really do. I mean, in the end, they didn't care or know even what the geopolitical aspects of this, the whole thing were. But you just go in for your buddy and you try to make the best of it. And, you know, you join the armed forces and you kind of realize that there's always that chance you get called to war. That's the difference in 2003 is that I don't think those Marines actually thought they told me they never thought they'd get called to war. I mean, for decades we've been, you know, have a military as a deterrent. We haven't gone to war. And all of a sudden, they're thrust into war. Now, soldiers who joined after 9/11, they know they're going to war. And those who are
They were mixed with the others who just joined up and had no idea that something like this would happen. Is that
That's
right?
That's true. That's true, yeah. But by now, I mean, I think a lot of the soldiers, like on this last convoy out, they were post 9/11, entering the force post 9/11. They kind of knew that they were going. A lot of them for patriotic reasons, for different reasons. But they kind of knew that there was a 90% chance that at some point they're going to deploy to Afghanistan or Iraq. And they're going to be engaged, you know, faced with this decision to fight.
Yeah.
So there was quite a bit of difference. But yeah, it's interesting.
Here's Lance Corporal Velasquez from the film Virgin Soldiers. It's interesting. He's sort of reflecting on what has to be, I guess, the essential question for a soldier. Am I ready to kill someone, or what's it going to be like?
I never thought in my life that I would honestly ever kill someone, you know. But it's like any moment now, you know, things could be hitting the fan and I could be face-to-face, you know, killing people, you know, and it's I don't know, it's kind of hard, you know? I mean, you know, it's hard to know that you're going to be killing someone, taking their life, you know, that, you know, God gave them life, you know, and now you're, you know, it kind of makes you like, who are you to take away someone's life, you know? But in this situation, it's if you're not thinking like, you know, like by that, you know, then it's like, well, then if you don't kill him, then it's basically saying you're giving the guy the right to kill you, you know what I mean?
How do you establish trust with the soldiers? So they were really candid with you, I have to say, in 2003. And I wonder, but these were in the earliest days.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, you sensed some uncertainty about what are we doing here? There were kind of debates that there was one particular moment in Virgin Soldiers I loved where you had these two soldiers who were, they'd signed up for war clearly, but they were having this debate about whether
it was right to do
to do what they were doing.
Yeah. I was surprised by how informal and how open it was within the tent. You know, we had two platoons in that tent. There were 80 of us living in that tent. And they had a lot of open discussions. And I was glad that it was refreshing they were able to have that open discussion. So they did. They debated this a lot. There were a lot of Marines there that thought, I don't know if we should be here, that, you know, we're not the world's cop. Why should we be straightening other people's messes out? And others felt like we totally needed to go in. So it was kind of interesting. But in the end, again, it boiled down to, but we joined the force and this is our mission, and so we have to carry it out. So I'm fighting for you, whether I agree, you know, even with the Marine next to you, whether, you know, your political sentiment or party affiliation or whatever, you still fought for the next guy. There was something I was going to say about – oh, what was really interesting listening to Velasquez again after – I haven't heard it for a while. This is the biggest discussion or debate is about killing.
Yeah.
And every Marine in that squad had a little different view on it. Some said, no problem. Others were like, I don't know. Others were like, how would I do mano a mano? Like, they didn't really picture a thing where you're going to shoot somebody over the horizon. They're pictured something like close combat or close quarters attack, like maybe, which didn't really happen so much in the first invasion until, like, you know, later, 2004, later, like Battle of Fallujah, where you had actual door to door fighting, house fights.
Like urban warfare, sort of.
Yeah, really intense urban war fighting, and Al Najaf and Fallujah in different places. But everyone handled it a little differently. My perspective was, there was listening to some of the commanders, there was a concern that would the Marines pull the trigger? I mean, this is a young force, never been to war before. And I think the opposite occurred, that they easily pulled the trigger. I mean, time and time and time again, so much so that I thought they actually had to really not rein it back, but really make sure of those targets. Because, you know, there's this idea of if you wait a split second, then you could be dead because the enemy could pull the trigger on you. But so I think there was a jump in the beginning that we were pulling the trigger all the time and then sorting out who we were targeting aftermath. And in many cases, it wasn't an enemy so much as it was just a confused population.
Yeah.
And I think that was, you know, troubling for a lot of, you know, Marine Corps, you know, Marines and soldiers. But, I mean, overall, you know, I think it was certainly one of the more interesting aspects of the conflict.
Let me play a clip I found really interesting, because this happened to several times in the course of those days as you guys were making your way to Baghdad. You would have a particular mission that you were to engage, and there was all kinds of shooting going on. And then after the fact, you would realize that there wasn't much resistance, in fact, that people had fled if they did any shooting at all. But you're just, you know, all this anxiety that builds up, and then it just sort of depletes you. There's this particular moment. It's a Corporal Thompson. We'll also hear from Corporal Diaz, who seemed like kind of the voice of reason in that group. He was an interesting fellow. But so reacting to that first firefight, the fact that they didn't actually get any resistance, but they had actually for the first time started shooting at something. This is from the film Virgin Soldiers.
And it was, I don't want to say a letdown, but, you know, I'd built myself up, you know, to be prepared to be in a firefight. And then I wasn't. It was just, found out, though, afterward I was really tired. I had exhausted myself because I was preparing to be in a firefight, preparing to be shot at. Kind of stressful.
Who really wants to get shot at? So I guess it was kind of good fortune, then, really. Think about it. But for some guys, they'll say that, oh, I wish I could have done this, I wish I could have done that, but I don't know. I'm happy just the way I was.
Has that changed at all?
I think the sentiment has changed. I mean, I look at the war and sort of I see it in four different phases. There's the invasion period, where we kept having targets, but every time we got there, most time the Iraqis had bugged out.
Yeah.
And then as traveling to the next target, then you'd get hit by an ambush, and so you'd have to respond. But it was like a hit and run. They'd never stand and fight, and so you didn't really still have this sort of fight that you envision as a soldier. Then you had a brief period of sort of stability operations, whatever they wanted to call it. Then you went into a full-blown insurgency. And at that point, the war really changed. I mean, people are getting hit by IEDs. Every convoy going outside the wire was getting hit by an IED. People were taking casualties, every unit, on a weekly, if not a daily basis. And then the war, you know, completely changed in that sense. And then there was really big stand-up fights like Fallujah and a few of the others, where there's a lot of urban fighting. And so it just depended when you were there. And for many of these soldiers and Marines, I mean, we talked to one soldier. He's been in the Army now 60 months, he told us, and he spent 30 months in Iraq.
Wow.
So his entire military career is basically prepare to go to Iraq, go to Iraq, come home, prepare to go to Iraq, go back to Iraq, go, you know, go back and prepare again, go back to Iraq. And now he's on the final pull. And I think for him it was really a nice – he actually called it bittersweet.
Wow.
Because he's like, this is all I know. My entire military career has been based in fighting in Iraq. So it goes, I'm so glad to be on the last convoy. It's sort of a sense of closure, but it's bittersweet because I don't know anything else as a soldier. I thought that was really interesting. But
This is the most striking moment from your film, Virgin Soldiers, because when you compare it to how long we actually ended up being there, it's a reflection of Lance Corporals Velasquez and Hartman here. And again, they were kind of griping about the fact that this it took days to get there and trying to sort of catch some shut-eye every, you know, a couple of minutes here, a couple of minutes there. They were exhausted. So you hear that kind of – but then you'll hear Lance Corporal Hartman's sort of reflection – or his projection, I guess, of what to expect. It's really interesting in light of where we've been. Another clip here from Virgin Soldiers.
It gets pretty stressful because some people are trying to get shut-eye and then you're all touching each other. At least five people touch each other at the same time and one person moves to get more comfortable and wakes everybody up. And then you got like us up here that want to sit down, so we wake everybody up to get two or three people up here. So it's not a good life.
I can't explain it until you actually get in it. And then you know how terrible the ride is.
Soon it will be all over. Iraq will be liberated. And we will be drinking Jack Daniels to celebrate.
You need an obscenity meter. We
do. Well, you know, it's soldiers, and I think people get the fact.
My wife always complains that after a deployment or in bed that I come back and I swear a lot more, and I'm sure I do because it's just so much part of the vocabulary. But
there he is saying, soon it will be over. What was your projection? What did you think was going to happen?
Well, I told people when I came back from that embed after being out there for 3 or 4 months, I said, you know, we'll be in Iraq at least 10 years. So I was a little long. Yeah. But part of that, it needs to be clarified. They're Marines. And so they always viewed the Marine Corps as expeditionary force, yeah, that they would come in, seize and hold, and then turn it over to the Army. The issue was that we needed a lot of bodies in Iraq over the last 9 years. And so the Marines didn't go home and turn it over to the Army. They stayed and then redeployed and redeployed and redeployed alongside with the Army. But those young Marines, true to their service, they thought they'd be more expeditionary, season hold, and then leave. But it just didn't happen that way. It was, you know, became a full-blown insurgency, and the Marines took whole sections like Al Anbar Province, Al Asad Air Base was a Navy Marine Corps air base. So that's probably part of why he's saying that.
But people's expectations were – not that it would be easy. I mean, you know, American politicians, a lot of them thought it would be – you'd be greeted as liberators, we'll be gone.
And we were greeted as liberators amongst the Kurds and the Shia. But I always wondered about the post-invasion plan. I mean, I'm not privy to what goes on in the DOD, but I always wondered what Rumsfeld's post-invasion plan was, because at least on the ground after we seized Baghdad and President Bush declared the end of combat operations, it didn't seem like we had a post-invasion plan. And so it's just one of those things I've never been able to sort out, because when we got to our position in Baghdad and we took our little section and we took a building and a little compound and we made it into our own, we kicked out security, went up on the roof, and I looked around and 360-degree and Baghdad was burning. It was just burning, and people were looting, and Iraqis were coming up to us at the front gate and saying, you know, someone just killed my uncle. Can you – you know, there's no law and order. Can you help us? And we were – you know, the unit I was with was a company, 208 plus me. And so we didn't have the strength to barely, you know, to do anything. You know, we had a little quadrant of Baghdad, and we were just told to hold fast and wait, you know, and so they were trying to sort out what was going on. But meanwhile, you know, things just sort of really fell apart as far as the rule of law.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about what it was like then. Talk about what it's like to take a huge operation and pack up and leave when we get back from a break. Dodge Billingsley is with us, the director of Combat Films, a political and military think tank and documentary film company based here in Salt Lake City. Scott Thornton, we're going to hear from him, a producer at Combat Films. He's joining us as well. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the local filmmaker, Dodge Billingsley. He was there when the U.S. first invaded Iraq in 2003, talked to the troops in those early days of war. Billingsley has returned to Iraq last month as the U.S. military withdrew troops from Al-Anbar province. He's joining us to talk about how things have changed or not. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So if you're a soldier, Dodge Billingsley, in Iraq, if you're a rank and file, you know, combat infantry soldier, where do you want to be? Do you want to be in Iraq, or is Afghanistan where all the action is?
Well, you know, there are probably a lot of opinions on that, but it's interesting to me, all the soldiers I've spoken to in the last year, many of them for the last 2 years actually felt that going to Iraq was the sideshow and they'd much rather be in Afghanistan. So there is still, you know, a fighting. I mean, soldiers join to fight. A fair number of them still join for those heroic visions of defending the country from proving themselves man to man. And they're – especially the rank and file. And so they want to be in Afghanistan where the fight is.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if they really want to be in Afghanistan, if they really think it through. But, I mean, they do want to be in Afghanistan. They complain about being in Iraq. But part of that is Iraq became what they call advise and assist. You know, that was the brigade mission for the last couple of years where you're just advising the Iraqi army units, assisting them, training them. And I think it was a little tedious. I think, you know, it's just tedious, you know. So I think it's partially driven by that.
What was the mission? They were, and in many ways, they were. Of course, they couldn't just say, "Hey, we're going to leave on Wednesday." I mean, that would have been dangerous. But there was a sense that, of course, the U.S. was getting ready. I mean, what was the strategy? What was the mission to get out of there? To leave?
Oh, you mean for Al-Anbar province,
exactly.
Al-Asad?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the strategy was to draw the force down as much as possible. Turn over all the physical facilities to the Iraqi units co-located on the base, because on Al-Asad Air Base, there's a Special Forces Battalion and the division headquarters for the Iraqi 7th Division, as well as some Air Force personnel, because it's a huge airstrip. It's a, you know, functioning airfield as well. So, but because we trust the Iraqi army units, but not fully, we didn't want to sort of advertise when we were going to drive out, because information would just go out and then let people prepare IEDs against us on the route out. So the trick was to withdraw as much as they could by air, and then the remaining tactical vehicles, which I think they said there were 99, I didn't count them, but 99 fully armored mine-resistant vehicles and convoy trucks that just had to be driven out, that the minimum number of soldiers to protect that convoy and get it out all the way through. And that turned out to be just shy of 400 troops, I think I was told, 367 or 76 or something like that. And then sort of provide enough disinformation so they could tell the Iraqis are leaving on one day, but then just leave immediately a lot sooner than that. Like we told the Iraqis – I mean, we didn't tell, but the unit commander told us that he had been telling the Iraqis they would leave on the 20th, when all along we knew we were leaving on the 8th. But, we were not supposed to obviously broadcast that message that we were leaving on the 8th. But meanwhile, they were withdrawing more troops via the airfield. But once the airfield closed down, there was just those 380-some soldiers left. We all sort of moved around one living support area, life support area, Iwo Jima, and we just bring all the mine-resistant vehicles, the MRAPs around it, sort of like a little Fort Apache. And that was that was the entire position of U.S. forces. And the base is 27 like square miles, but we were basically down to, what, 4 football fields? That was it. And we didn't control anything else in the base. Everything else had been completely abandoned. And then 48 hours before we left, the unit commander from 4-6 Infantry advised the Iraqi Special Forces Intelligence Commander, the S2, that they would be leaving on the 8th at 6. And by 9 a.m. on the 8th, we would be gone, every last U.S. person. There would be no more U.S. personnel in that base. Because at some point, you have to sort of share with your partners, but you wanted to wait till the very end.
Yeah.
And so you waited till as long as possible.
What was it like, I mean, to close a major military installation? I mean, they had been, as you say, drawing down. But what were the logistics like to shut that operation down finally?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it has a number of things. There was closing the airfield, which is under Air Force Command. The base command group was actually naval. And they worked with the Army, which secured everything, the unit we were with, 4/6 Infantry, with an element of the 82nd Airborne. And then there was the Air Force who ran the tower and the airfield. But they even flew those guys out a week, I think like 2 or 3 weeks prior, so they had what was called an uncontrolled airfield. So basically the C-130s and C-17s landed on their own accord with just minimal help with the Lieutenant Colonel Goodlett, in fact, who was manning what was left of the Air Force staff. So there was that. And they were shipping out most of the sensitive data. I mean, sorry, sensitive equipment, you know. So that was going pallet after pallet after pallet into these C-17s and moving all that stuff out. Probably 6 to 7 C-17s, C-130s a day, every day up to the last day they left. I mean, it was just getting that stuff out. The Army, they were basically just drawing down their size and their footprint within the base and just trying to make sure they were secure. Still going on perimeter patrols. They went on 4 perimeter patrols every day. We went on some route clearance patrols. We wanted to do everything to make it look like we were conducting business as usual so that the Iraqis wouldn't get a sense like, hey, wait a minute, the U.S., they're not doing what they normally do. Are they gone? Are they leaving? Or let's take a look and see what they're doing. So,
Scott Thornton, let me ask you, I guess, what did you expect and what were your impressions? It's your first time there, your first time embedded with a group of from the U.S. military. What did you make of it all?
Well, we had the advantage of talking to the unit several months prior, so I kind of had a picture of what it was going to be like over there, and I knew that we were going for a logistics story, not so much a combat story. So I knew not to expect a lot of action, so to say, but also to expect an enhanced threat, because historically, when you're pulling back a force or closing down a base, you are at your most least secure, I guess.
Yeah.
So I kind of knew going in that it was going to be a unique embedded experience. I didn't know how strange and bizarre it would be, because when we showed up on the base, it was a ghost town for the most part. It used to house over 10,000 soldiers. And by the time we got there, there was a little over, I think there's 1,000. And then we watched the rest of them go. And as Dodge said earlier, we just watched the security perimeter shrink and shrink and shrink till pretty soon, I mean, there's just a handful of guys there. And we kind of had the run of the base driving around, and there's just nobody there. All these huge facilities, waste management, power, and nobody to watch them. And for me, that was really strange, just to kind of see this abandoned billion-dollar facility with nobody there to guard it.
We left like 800 SUVs there, just keys in the floorboard that the Iraqis will inherit. In fact, that's when we got in. That's the first thing the base, the 4/6 Infantry Commander told us. He goes, you'll need a vehicle. Let's go find one. If you see one with the keys on the floorboard, that means that person has left.
Wow.
So take it. So we had a Ford Explorer, which was great. So we just did whatever we wanted to do. We drove all around. You know, we went back and forth from the Air Force to the Navy to the Army contingents until it was only the Army contingents were left. But that was weird. It was weird.
Eerie? Is that what you mean?
Very eerie. I mean, Dodge was actually there for the last Air Force flight going out. He'll probably explain it better than I will.
That was really weird, because I wanted to see that last C-130, because they didn't have any security at that point. Also, what typically happens is C-130 will land. They kick their own Air Force security out. Guys with their machine guns and, you know, M4s will come out, secure the plane. The very last base command group and the Air Force personnel, even the lieutenant colonel, will get on the plane, and that's it. There's no more presence there. And as I, you know, said goodbye to those guys, and that C-130, you know, flew off, and I looked around, I was on the airfield. I was the last American on the airfield and the only person on the airfield. And it was a little eerie, because it was this massive, you know, expansive air base. And I walked out to the runway because I could, because there was no one else to tell me I couldn't.
Right.
And I just thought, my car looks a long ways away. I think I need to get back to my car. So yeah. I kind of, you know, double timed it back to the vehicle, which was probably 400 or 500 yards away at that time, and then drove away. And the like 7 or 8 minute drive then down the hill to the Army, where I felt like, okay, there's some more Americans. But that was it. The airfield was closed. There was no one else there. There was no presence. There were vehicles parked haphazardly with their emergency flashers on, where we just left them.
Wow.
It was done. Control tower was empty.
Then you would walk through the living area, even the last morning we were there, and soldiers had left. The heat was still on. The lights were still on. All the systems were still running, and it was like they just dropped whatever they were doing, got in their vehicles, and drove away.
What will come of that? It's just – it's the Iraqis now.
It's the Iraqis, yeah. And that was a big problem because even up to the day before we left, some of the Air Force contingents were asking a 466 infantry commander to construct some T-wall barriers to sort of – there was a big fear that the Iraqi units co-located on the base will fight over what we left. And they probably are. So there's not quite the sense that it's the Iraqis. You just stay in place and somebody from the Ministry of Defense will come down and divvy it all out and say Air Force here, Army here, Special Ops here. But no, those three units seem like they were really going to do a fight for the spoils of what we left behind, which, like as Scott mentioned, was billions of dollars of stuff. And in fact, the one base commander, he was an assistant base commander. He was actually a P-3 Orion pilot by trade, a surveillance plane for the Navy. And he thought, man, I wish I could be in my P-3 the day we leave to just watch what goes on in this base with these Iraqi units and to see, because there will be blood. I don't know if there was, but I mean, he just – you did get the sense that the Iraqis were going to carve it up, and you just don't know. I don't know.
We talked to a lot of the contractors on the civilian side, a lot of people who handled the information networks and some of the infrastructure. And a lot of what we heard back to me was amazing because you have million-dollar communication systems that they all said will get broken down and stripped for the wire.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you guys feel conflicted about that? I mean, that this is just the way it has to happen, or are we doing it right, or is it just – I mean, what did you think about all of that? What were your conclusions? Did you come into any conclusions
about
that?
I have one conclusion I felt long before this, but it was reinforced by this, is that if you're going to be invaded by a country, you want to be invaded by the United States, because the second we destroy the country, we start rebuilding it. And I'm not, you know, it's just a fact. We do. We have, you know, we destroyed large portions of that country.
Bridges in Baghdad.
To depose the regime, you know, and, you know, to isolate the Ba'athist based army, et cetera, et cetera. And then we went right to work and rebuilt it. And so we pumped, I don't even know how much money we pumped into that place, but, you know, obviously hundreds of billions of dollars, if not a trillion. I don't know over the 9-year process.
To establish kind of an infrastructure.
To establish an infrastructure to give the Iraqis, this new regime, a chance. And so even though you don't like – you have to kind of let them sort it out. They're going to have to sort it out. I mean, it was weird to leave so many SUVs and just the way we left them with the emergency lights on or the keys on the floor or the AC still running in the place where you've been sleeping for the last, you know, whatever, however long you were there. But they're going to have to sort that out. And because of the need for secrecy, not necessarily secrecy, but for security, not broadcast exactly when you're going to convoy 99 vehicles all the way out to K Crossing and into Kuwait, you kind of had to leave it a little bit, you know, quickly without basically, okay, here's the keys to this. And here, I mean, you did that. They did that basically, but there was those, but in many respects, they couldn't do it for security reasons. And you just hope the Iraqis can sort that out. I mean, it's their base.
Yeah, it is their base.
But
what did you make of the contractors, the American contractors that was there? I mean, that seemed a very distinct part of the sort of military complex now, where the amount of people who were, you know, contracting their services, food and all kinds of other services. What's going to come of them? Do you know?
Well, I'll let Scott go to this too. But the only contractors left on Al Asad when we were there were the fire department, the guys that ran the fire trucks at the airfield. Everybody else was gone. The dining facilities. In fact, that's one hardship I guess I should have thought through more clearly, but we had to eat MREs the whole time we were there, and I hate those things. But we ate them for, you know, 2.5 months up to Baghdad before, and I thought, I'll never eat those again, not for such a long period of time. So I was actually glad my trip was only 2 weeks because we did eat them basically every day. There were no dining facilities or no infrastructure. But there were a lot of contractors in Kuwait, and I don't know, do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, that's where we had most of our contact with them, especially because it takes several days to process in and out of the Kuwait side of things. And in overhearing a lot of conversations with them, you get a sense that on the soldier side of things, they're very excited to be coming home for the most part. But on the contractor side of things, they wish they had one more year. A lot of these guys are coming from poorer backgrounds, that military service was their gateway into contracting, which pays very well. And they're realizing that that is going to start drying up in the next year or so. And they're all just kind of wishing they could get one more year and save up a little bit more, because once that avenue's gone, they're not quite sure where the next one's going to pop up. Mm.
Yeah, that was kind of depressing, sitting listening to some of these people, you know, like in some of the waiting areas where we were, listening to some of these contractors talk about that, because they were making loads of money servicing, you know, in Iraq and Kuwait and Afghanistan, because, you know, you get a tax benefit and you get, you know, all kinds of different incentive pay. And so they made a lot of money, far more than they're going to make anywhere in the States, most likely.
I mean, these were whole culture. It's a whole culture that was on these bases, it seems. A whole kind of ecosystem almost.
Yeah, I mean, having, you know, fighting now, been at war for 10 years, Afghanistan and Iraq, yeah, you've developed an entire culture, subculture of that. Well, but it's going to draw to an end.
And several contractors who've actually just located their family over to Kuwait,
yeah,
because they're either in Iraq or they're in Afghanistan and they're staging out of Kuwait. And so the only time they get to see their families is in Kuwait. So they've brought them over there.
Scott Thornton is with us. He's a producer at Combat Films. Dodge Billingsley is the director. It's a political and military think tank and documentary film company based here in Salt Lake City. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us local filmmaker Dodge Billingsley, who was there when the U.S. first invaded Iraq in 2003. He returned to Iraq last month as the military withdrew troops from Al-Anbar province. He's the director of Combat Films. It's a political and military think tank and documentary film company. Scott Thornton is also with us, a producer at Combat Films. He was there as the last troops left Iraq. Let me ask you... What did we do to that country, of course, is the kind of complicated question. What's your sort of – I know there are lots of different kinds of ways of taking on that question. But what's your – when you hear people say, what did we – how did we leave that country? Mm-hmm. What's your response to that, Dodge Billingsley?
Well, what did we do to that country? We disenfranchised the entire group, the Sunnis. We changed the regime. We put – the Shias in power for the time being because they hold a majority stake. I mean, they have a parliamentary system and a constitution that is sort of designed to not allow another strongman like Saddam to come into power. But at the same time, you might call it a muddling democracy because it's going to be hard to get anything done. So we've empowered the Shias. We've empowered the Kurds. We've sort of disenfranchised the Sunnis to a degree. But I think more than that, we've changed the entire balance of power in the Middle East because Iran, you know, which now – certain elements in the country are, you know, we've got to go to war with Iran, or we've got to deal with Iran. We're only having to deal with Iran, in my opinion, because we took away their two natural enemies, the Taliban in the east and Saddam's Sunni regime in the west. So we didn't necessarily like Saddam, and neither did the Saudis or anybody else, but he was sort of this like frontal pressure right on the west, you know, on Iran. And so we've really changed the balance of power. So we've changed Iraq, but we've also changed the balance of power in the region. And we're going to – I don't know if it's bad or good. It's just that that's what we did. And so it's going to take – we'll be sorting this new balance of power out for decades.
Sectarian violence, I think you've made the point that it didn't start when the U.S.
Right.
Went into Iraq. Won't end as the United States leaves either.
Right. I mean the Sunni-Shia violence, at one point they're going to have to sort this out for themselves. And I don't know if they will. It existed a long time before we got there. We may have exacerbated a bit by empowering one group over the other. Some called that middle phase in there, 2006, 2007, a virtual civil war of which we became a third-party player in the civil war. I don't know if it's fair to characterize it by that, but it can be argued that that was a good characterization. Ultimately, they're going to have to sort this out. They have everything going for them in the sense in the region they have a lot of natural resources. Of course, we're talking about oil.
Yep.
But no one took their oil. They still have all their oil. They get to sign out the contracts. They could become a very wealthy state, which would mean a better living standard for everybody in the state if they can pull it off. I don't
know
if
they
will. If they do, it'll be a bumpy road. I mean, you have a flashpoint up with the Kurds. And some people tell you it's not a flashpoint, but I think the Kurdish Arab, I mean, it's a flashpoint because the Kurds have sort of semi-autonomy up there. They have oil resources. They
this
have
is the northern region.
Yeah, the northern region. Right. They have a pipeline that runs to Ceyhan, Turkey. So they are kind of self-contained. They can pump the oil, get it out to Turkey, to the global markets, become really wealthy area of Iraq and not share it. And it's not necessarily under civil or – I'm sorry, it's not civil, but federal authority in Baghdad. And that's – I think that's the recipe for a problem. They're going to have to sort that stuff out. And the same with the oil fields in the south. I mean, those are under sort of Shia control, you know, and then you have – you know, so there's a lot of challenges ahead for Iraq.
Do you hear the kind of enduring question that came up a lot and still does of whether or not you can take Western culture and transplant it into a, you know, into the Middle East? What do you make of that? Can you, with so many – I mean, did the United States presence there, how did it change Iraqi culture, if at all did? Did you – Gain any wisdom regarding that question, do you think?
That's an interesting question. I do think in Iraq you have more of a chance than, say, Afghanistan. Because Iraq, I mean, I would characterize, I know this is debatable in academic circles, but I mean the Ba'athist regime was very secular, in my opinion. I mean, they say, oh, it's not secular, it's totally different. But it was very secular in nature. Not too many Islamic extremists running around in Saddam's Iraq. And so you took a fairly, what I'd consider, liberal Iraqi society, and you brought in Western values, which should blend right in with the tendencies that, you know, the pre-U.S. invasion Iraq had. In fact, you'll see that in their own media and in just popular television shows and, you know, all kinds of things like that. But as far as exporting Western values like of democracy, I think it's okay as long as we don't brand it or say it has to be a U.S.-style democracy or U.S.-style Western value. There's plenty of European social democracy systems and other, like the Turkish model. There's lots of different ways they could incorporate what might become a more democratic process in the country that protects the rights of all elements of all three minority, all three ethnic groups, the Shias, Sunnis, and the Kurds. But I don't, you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
Right now, it looks like it's on track to do that. I thought one thing that was really significant was that, you know, Maliki and Obama's press conference together about the closing of U.S. the final withdrawal of U.S. troops. I actually thought that was an interesting press conference, and I liked it in the sense that you had two presidents up there. Now, of course, the security agreement obviously was instigated by the Bush administration, but you had two presidents up there, the president of the country that we invaded and the president of the country, the invading force, and they stood up there together and they showed this sort of unity. And who knows? Iraq may gravitate toward another country, not the U.S. at all. But the fact that they're able to stand up there, the president's able to, like, do his business as the president, I think Iraq, you know, we'll see where it goes.
It's interesting. There wasn't any no grand statements like mission accomplished in those moments. The U.S. was pretty careful, it seemed.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, the first one certainly fell flat. Everybody in Baghdad is going, what? There's no mission accomplished yet.
Right.
He said, what? Because I remember that. We were, you know, in Baghdad, you didn't hear anything at the time. They would say, oh, yeah, I said on the aircraft carrier. But, you know, we didn't get that news feed. So we just think, what? That's interesting.
Are we really gone? I mean, is the U.S. really, you know, so many combat brigades are remaining in Kuwait. And, you know, it's not like there aren't any forces there. So, the U.S. is still very much a presence in many ways.
We have an interest in that region. We will for the future, but it's on multiple layers. I mean, you're right. There's discussions, I guess, that I've heard from the Kuwaiti government to keep at least – well, we know we're going to keep at least one combat brigade, but maybe up to three in Kuwait. But that serves a lot of different purposes. Many in Iraq still feel that Kuwait is part of Iraq, that this boundary was artificially drawn up by – British civil servants a long, long, long time ago, and that why in the world is Kuwait independent anyway? And so the Kuwaitis, I think, I'm going to presume that they have nothing to lose by having us there. Plus, we're not in Kuwait City. We're out in the middle of the nowhere in these desert bases, Camp Virginia, Camp Bering, and Ali al-Salim. And so we're removed from the population, but we can keep a substantial force there, which is a nice sort of check and balance against any type of perhaps future Iraqi aggression. But we're also there in case there's any sort of Iranian aggression against Iraq, I think. So it serves a purpose to have a foothold still in the region. We have a lot of allies there, the United Arab Emirates, you know, and the Saudis and a lot of others. And Iran, again, is the balance of power shifted a bit. And so I think there's a lot of players in the region that welcome U.S. presence there. But they're out of Iraq.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how many we're going to keep in Kuwait.
What were the troops saying in those last days about – I mean, what were their reflections about these, about the final moments? Did they have it? Did you gather anything, Scott or you, Dodge?
Well, I asked that question of a lot of them, and it was a mixed reaction. But the overriding theme that I got as far as should we be leaving now and is it worth it, was it worth it, is that overwhelmingly, yes, we should be leaving now. Not many thought we should stay and maybe thought we were there a year or two too long. And on whether or not it was worth it, I think in order to kind of search for a justification of the mission, it's not victory in the traditional sense, as we're leaving and the job isn't necessarily all the way done, but it's probably as done as it's going to be. And the way that the soldiers I talk to view it is that we've given them an opportunity to do something with their country, to forge a new national identity and have a democratic republic. That's probably the best we can do, and that's where our sense of victory lies.
I spend a lot of time thinking about information operations and media, and I'm obviously not against the media because I'm part of the media, but I wonder how we would have felt about the immediate aftermath of World War II had we been driven by 24-hour news cycles and the web and the ability to push information out. Every single little blip, you know, it becomes a Twitter feed, and so you don't even – there's too much scrutiny. I mean, give Iraq the time to sort it all out, and will there be sectarian violence and bombings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Yes. But does it have to be on the front page of every news story? In other words, it could be blown out. One bombing doesn't make a trend necessarily. The trend could still be upward. Iraq could really become a stable regime in the Middle East, which would probably maybe be good for the Middle East. But when you take every isolated incident on its own and it's driven by the pace of media dissemination today, it's just it's a hard world to navigate. And I just wonder if it was back in the 1940s and 50s, if it would be a little easier.
Let me ask you this finally. Dr. Billingsley, about 30 seconds left. You seem optimistic. Are you?
Yeah, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic because I don't think there's any sort of dishonor in the way we withdrew the force. We put together a security agreement in the last presidential with the last presidential administration. This presidential administration honored it. The Iraqis, it was time to go. They sort of felt that way more so than not, or else we'd still be there. So I think we withdrew within the terms of the agreement, and I think that's honorable. I think we have to do a fair amount of rebuilding the force here, and Iraq will have to sort that out. But I guess I'm just optimistic by nature.
Dodge Billingsley, director of Combat Films, and Scott Thornton, a producer at Combat Films. Gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.